For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, if you weren't here, this was likely actually 2 weeks ago. We went over the first four laws, commands that govern our relationship with God. As Jesus said, the two great commands, one is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so this is seen in the first four commandments. No other God but me. No idols or images. No misuse of the name Yahweh, which we saw is probably referring to either to magic, trying to gain power over Yahweh by misusing his name. Swearing, also false swearing. And observe the Sabbath day, which was the memorial of this covenant. This particular covenant was memorialized in the Sabbath day. Okay, so we saw that all moral thinking and any kind of universal, objective moral standard that's actually binding on people, other than their just simply arbitrary desire to adopt certain moral rules that they feel are appropriate, that if there's going to be any kind of overarching moral sense of true right and wrong that's binding on everyone, it has to have a base. It has to be based on something, a universal standard like that. And it's based on the creator of all things, God. And that's why our starting point is to come to God. Apart from a creator God, morality, moral thinking itself is nothing but a social construct. It's nothing but an imaginary standard that we set up and may agree to with some a few people, but it's irrelevant. Here's a verse in Isaiah 44 that we read last week where he says, "Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and there is no God besides me." Straight monotheism. I'm God. There's one God. I'm the creator of everything. Nobody created me. I've always been here. And I'm always going to be here. First and the last. That's a way of saying that. And so when you look at this proposition, if you reach a point where you start to realize, and you would have to unfold a lot of, why we believe this is true. But if you do accept that as a true statement, then that leads to changes in the person who accepts this proposition, that there is one eternal and almighty God who exists, who is the creator of all. For one thing, it takes me from the position of number one and moves me down. Now I'm the creature. He's the creator. He's above me. I'm under him. And it changes then your perspective on everything else. This whole world is his creation. And so too with other people here, created according to the Bible in the image of God, that changes our perspective toward other people as well. And so there's just a whole different paradigm shift that goes on between the assumption that I'm just here and I'm me and I'm starting out for myself versus no, I am under a creator who made me. And so flowing from this change in perspective comes a change in the way we relate to other people. And the next six rules that he puts out govern our relationship to other human beings. Each of them are their moral principles that are general and yet signify. They're basically, each of them are kind of indicating a direction, in which to think about it. Verse 12, honor your father and mother. Then you'll live a long, full life in the land your Lord, your God will give you. Okay, one part of this is that if we're in a wrong relationship to God, if we're not submitted to God, people tend to become ungrateful. They have no appreciation for what other people invested into them. And so this is a commandment that's telling us that that shouldn't be, and that we should develop a sense of appreciation and gratitude for our parents. it also shows that God is saying here, we're starting with parents and their children, and that is the family. The Bible brings this up at quite a few places, but that this whole community is going to be based on the family. He's setting up here a future, you know, society, of community that's going to be there for, you know, really 1,500 years before they finally got dispersed. And so part of this covenant is setting that up, and the family is going to be the center. That's the beginning point. Now, of course, we have to qualify this, I think, what Walter Kaiser says, that parents are to be shown honor, but nowhere is their word to rival or to be a substitute for God's word. And that is true throughout the Bible. You know, in fact, this whole thing of honoring your parents has become kind of problematic. What if your parents just simply forbade you to be a follower of Jesus? You're going to obey that? No, there's times when we have to turn against the will of our parents and have be courageous enough to do that. And yet we can still hold them in honor, even as we say, I'm not going to be able to comply with what you want on this. I'm going the direction that I know is right, but I'll still honor you as my parents. Of course, today the whole concept of the family has been pretty savagely distorted, as we'll detail later tonight. The family in our culture is really a broken thing. And a lot of times I just sat and listened to a story. A girl the other night was telling her story of her life. And she had been abandoned by every parent and loved one in her life, had ditched her with extreme prejudice. And the father marries this stepmother who didn't like her, and then all of a sudden he abandons her and leaves her with the stepmother who had no use for her. And you just sit there and think, this would not be an easy verse for that girl to honor. Do those people really deserve honor for that? This little girl just being abandoned, tossed aside like a rag? That's pitiful, shameful. Well, you know, again, we have to read this through the lens. We're reading an ancient text to ancient people. You know, probably these were all intact families. They were probably relatively well adjusted compared to what you see in the modern world. In the modern culture, family is crumbling to pieces. And whereas here we're probably talking about a basically an agrarian type society where families were intact and basically not that bad. British commentator Cole says talks about our modern world where youth is worshipped and old age is dreaded or despised. He thinks that part of this command is to give us to have respect for the aged. You know, to honor them for what they've been through, for the experience they've accumulated. That's probably a good point as well. Verse 13, you must not murder. Thou shalt not kill was the King James, and that's been traditional, but that's really not a good translation of this fairly unusual word. Rashah, Cole says, is a comparatively rare word for kill, and usually implies violent killing of a personal enemy. Murder is a good translation for it. It's murder that he's talking about. It couldn't be any and all killing, seeing as how this very same law code, as we read on in chapter 21, prescribes capital punishment for certain crimes. So it's not that you can never kill under any circumstance. This murder, which is unjustified killing of another person. And so we have here the obvious truth of the elevation of human life to a very high level, to where it cannot be taken. You can kill, you know, a cow that is your cow, and he's going to die anyway. And so that's okay. Under the Mosaic law, you can kill a cow. Even eat it. Humans, you cannot kill. They're different. than all other animals. They're to be treated in a completely, exalted way, never permitted to kill them. Even if the human got really old and was, not able to contribute anymore and just really sick and had to be taken care of all the time, you still cannot kill that person. That is a human being. Cannot kill him. And so we ask ourselves, and this came up last time we talked, why should humans be treated differently than other forms of life? Why should we believe in the sanctity of human life? It's all based on the rest of the picture. It's based on the existence of a personal infinite God, and it's based on his creation of humans according to the scriptures that he's revealed to us, that he created males and females in his image, in the image of God. We comes up again then in, after the story of Noah in the book of Genesis, that if a man kills another, sheds the blood of another man, then by man his blood will be shed. And so capital punishment was introduced at that time for murder, first degree murder. And it is still practiced today, even though we've bastardized the concept so badly today in our judicial system. I have to say, I am against capital punishment. Personally, I believe it's the way it's practiced today just totally defeats the purpose. And 20 years after someone commits a crime, they take them out and give them an injection or something, and there's no deterrence. And in this day, it was public, immediate, and basically everyone standing there was like, I don't think I want to do this. It was deterrence. It was also justice. It was also paying people what they deserve, because the act of killing a being as lofty, as important as another human deserves that level of punishment. Well, it's also kind of ironic that it would be hard to think of anything that characterizes humans more than murder. From the first family that ever existed, in Adam's first two children, one of them murdered the other. It was one of the first big crimes, the first big things recorded in the Bible. And right throughout history, murder, warfare, slaughter, and still today, in over 40 wars going on in our world as we speak, 25,000 murders in the United States every year. Humans uniquely are murderers, killers of their own. We say, well, a guppy will eat even its own babies. So guppy's a fish. Eats the babies because it's hungry. That could happen with a lot of species. They may eat their own species. But where are the species that would just kill and just leave the corpse there and just not for any reason? And then go out in these masses to kill one another, and no one can even, when they're later saying, why did this happen, can't even figure out why half the time. Murderous people. The Bible speaks to this in the book of Isaiah 59. Their feet run to evil and they hasten to shed blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Devastation and destruction are in their paths. They do not know the way of peace, and there is no justice in their tracks. They do not know the way of peace. Good description of humanity there. We've never known the way of peace. There's never been a single year or even a single day of peace in all likelihood in human history, ever, where there was complete peace for a single day. That's how bad it is. And this description is taken by Paul in the book of Romans 3 and applied to all people, that, there's murder in our hearts, the hostility, the inability. When you have lofty beings who become fallen beings, a fallen lofty being is worse by far than just a like an animal or something like that, which is all morally neutral, doesn't have that spiritual dimension. But it makes sense that the loftier and the higher a being is as when they're created, the lower they will go when they're in a fallen state, turned away from God. And so we find that the marks of fallenness in humanity are this extreme violence, aggression, and murder. Well, of course, the other thing we notice is that a lot of these laws are you shall not, not this, not that. And yet, the only reason for that is that it's just easier to explain, you know, what we shouldn't do. And it leaves open, you know, a million options for what we can do. And those are implied here. As Calvin says of this passage, God forbids us to injure and hurt our brother, for he would have us hold his life to be dear and valuable to us. This is really the point. Jesus, commenting on this same passage, when he taught on it in the Sermon on the Mount, said that, yeah, you're not allowed to murder, but he says even hating, even holding a brother, a sister in contempt, that's the seed that leads to murder. And a lot of people would murder if they felt they could get away with it. They'd love to see someone dead. If they could clap their hands and this person would disappear and be gone, they wouldn't hesitate. Boom. And that's murder in the heart. So there is murder in the heart of humanity. And just because he's telling us not to murder doesn't mean that it stops there. But rather, it's signaling us away from that contemptuous attitude and toward one where, as he says, we value and hold other people's lives dear to us. Verse 14, you shall not commit adultery, sexual immorality. Yeah, a huge area where you're either a giver and a lover of others or a taker. When we're under God, when we're linked to God and in relationship to him, he teaches us to become givers. That's a huge teaching in the Bible. But when we're separated from God and we're trying to aggrandize self, we're trying to promote self as self is number one, then we become takers. In this culture, in ancient culture, they didn't have birth control. And there were no, you know, universities to go to or anything like that. People got married young. Most people got married about the time they became sexually mature. Puberty, in other words. Most young people would have been married by the time they were 15. So, fornication, that is having sex as a single person, was possible, but relatively rare. Almost all sexual immorality in their society would have been adultery, which is sexual immorality within context of where you're married. And adultery is worse, according to the Old Testament, than fornication. Adultery is an extremely serious betrayal once you have taken the vows of marriage and you violate that and go out on a spouse. But I don't think we should just think of it in those terms. I believe that what he's pointing us to here is the whole area, you know, is just taking sexuality is a real classic area to think about because, you know, we've got the sex drive. All of us, you know, we desire sex. Sex seems awesome, and so we want a lot of sex. And it truly then becomes a ground where moral thinking is tested. Are we prepared to approach our sexuality in accordance with what God says sexuality should be like? Or do we feel that we have a better idea? We have to understand that God has created the world a certain way. So when he comes and tells us, here's how you should live, he's telling us that in the light of the knowledge of how he made things. So you know, my car manual says I should put a certain gasoline in my car, that it takes a certain type of gas. I could get it to run probably with diesel fuel for a while. It would run for a while, but it would be very bad for the car, and it would break down before too long. So it would be foolish to go against the manufacturer's, you know, instructions, because they built it, they designed it, and they know what's going to run best. This is really what we're dealing with when it comes to God and these moral legislations that he gives us in the Old Testament. When we violate then God's created order, what we end up doing is illustrating why the order is what it is. And our life becomes kind of a living illustration of why it's not a good idea to go against the Creator's instructions for how things should work. In the book of Proverbs, God says, "For they hated knowledge and chose not to fear the Lord. They rejected my advice and paid no attention when I corrected them. Therefore, they must eat the bitter fruit of living their own way and choking on their own schemes." Your life will become an illustration of why going against God's will is not a very good idea. And frankly, this is all happening around us at all times, especially in the sexual area. When we come to the area of sexuality, modern Americans feel, first of all, Yahweh is wrong. They would say, this is all very ancient stuff. We don't need any of this. We have freedom today. We have, you know, we're not living under these ancient, crazy tribal codes that are all restrictive and don't allow for free expression of your sexuality and creativity and so forth. And in fact, we know better than what the author of this piece, who started it out saying, "I am Yahweh." Yeah, well, Yahweh's wrong then. That's our attitude in the modern world. We don't need this kind of restriction. Let's think about that a little bit, because I think, as a matter of fact, we have become an illustration of why it's not a good idea to go against the manufacturer's manual. And I think that what's happening in our culture today in the sexual area is a pretty good argument for maybe we do need to go back to what Yahweh says after all. Let's just think of a few areas of measurable, and I'm going to use for everything that I'm referring to, is all secular, not Christian, sociology. Okay, none of these are Christian authors. Unhappiness is one of the perils that we face when we decide, oh, I'm free to enter into sexual immorality if I want to. Here's a study done in behavioral pediatrics, development of behavioral pediatrics. Tests reveal that adolescents who were sexually active had significantly higher depression scores than non-sexually active subjects. I thought, you know, we believed in high school that, man, if you can get laid, that's where it's at. That's what's going to make you happy. This says that the more people had sex, and they say depression was positively correlated with the number of partners in the previous 3 months. The more sex you had and the more people you had it with, the higher your depression score goes. At the same time, having a strong sense of purpose in life was significantly negatively correlated with the number of sexual partners in the previous 3 months. So there's the sex immorality soars upward, your sense of purpose soars downward, your depression goes right up along with the immorality you're practicing, according to this study. One of the scariest things about sexual immorality is that it is impinging. It is impeding our ability in the future to form successful marriages. That family that lies at the center of the community in God's picture, what he wants, could be blocked. We're putting that goal out of our reach the more we engage in sexual immorality. Divorce becomes one of the corollaries here. People can't hold a marriage together, and divorce follows. We're in a huge tidal wave of divorce. People say, well, divorce has gone down since the 80s. That's only because divorce is married in divorces per 1,000 women. That's how divorce is married in sociological literature. The problem is they don't control for number of marriages. So that in the 80s, when it was 7 divorces per 1,000 in any given year, there were 14 marriages per 1,000 in any given year. So it was 50%. Half as many people got divorced as got married. Now divorce is down to 3.5 per 1,000 women per year. But marriage is also down to 7 per 1,000 women. So the ratio is exactly the same as it ever was. We are at historic high levels. The highest in the world, by the way, in the United States. We lead the world in this area. And what it means is, if you get married today, if these trends carry out until you're, which there's no reason to think they won't, you got almost a 50-50 chance that that marriage is going to end in the most horrific experience you've ever had in your life. You won't believe how bad it is when you become a divorcee. Others never even get married, so they just live together or whatever, and then those break up, so it's the same thing, really. And today we've got huge, breakups in the millions that are almost as bad because they're living together, having children together, and then you break up. What's the difference between that and a divorce? That's a legal difference, but not really a moral difference. And we have the destroyed children that all are a part of this nasty, grisly illustration of why it's not a good idea to go against what Yahweh says. Let's do some reading. Let's do a little reading. I want to familiarize you with just a couple of pieces on this. Percent of adults between 20 and 30 married in the U.S. in 1960 was 68%. Today, 27%. Marriage itself is rapidly declining. And success in marriage is not improving as a result. People actually believe today that putting marriage off, I have to put off marriage till I finish undergrad, then I got to finish grad school, then I got to get my career established, probably get my first house, secured, and then maybe I'll be ready to get married. So the average age of marriage now has gone up to like 27 and 28 in our culture. And it's not because people are saying, oh, well, I'll just put off my sexual life until I'm 28. I don't think that's happening at all. And so what it is we've just decided that, we can just have our sex and we don't need to accompany that with marriage. We'll get married later. Do you want to get married? The question posed to singles between 20 and 30, according to Pew Social Trends Families 2010, they're ambiguous. Less than half of them are sure that they do. And, all of them are probably active sexually. Not sure. So marriage itself is getting a bad reputation. Everyone has seen so much marital failure that, it's hard not to be cynical. Percentage of adults cohabiting in the U.S., 1965%. 2010, 48%. Good Lord! That's a tenfold increase in cohabitation. So this is living together with your lover, not married. It's definitely documents an increase in sexual immorality, but it also documents a decrease in people's confidence in their ability to be married. This is one of the reasons they live together. Is they want to be married someday, but they feel like, I just don't know if I'm ready. I don't know if it's safe. I'm afraid of what will happen if I get married. We'll just do this instead. This is Pompano and Whitehead study review of recent research. They're professors at Rutgers University. Living together before marriage increases the risk of breakup after marriage. Oh yeah, almost double. It goes from 40-some percent to 80-some percent of marriages that where you live together will end in divorce. Isn't that interesting? It's exactly the opposite of what people think in our culture. They think, well, you got to live with someone, you know, you got to live with them before you marry. What, you're just going to walk in blind to a marriage? You've never even had sex with this person before? What if there's some, you know, what if something's wrong? What if it's, I mean, you got to live together first. Then it'll be safer because you can get married because you'll already know what you're up against. Really? That makes sense under a human model. Yahweh says, you shall not commit adultery. That is, that will break you if you do that. And this says, yes, the opposite of what you think is what will really happen. Instead of being safer to get married, it's actually twice as perilous. Now you've just doubled your chances of divorce by living together. Unmarried couples have lower levels of happiness, lower levels of well-being than married couples. This is not the researcher's opinion. This is what the people themselves say. These are surveys they're reporting on, where the people have said, you know, rate your happiness between 1 and 10. The unmarried couples rate it lower. No positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage has ever been found. It's all negative, all harmful, and I'm picking out a few quotes. You should really read the whole thing. They say while marriages are held together largely by a strong ethic of commitment, cohabiting relationships by their very nature tend to undercut that ethic. Yes, they do. Confidence, willingness to commit, ability to commit is being undercut actively by taking this posture that, you know, I want to have sex with you and all, but I'm not willing to marry you. And you're basically, I'm here to take, I'm here to gratify myself, but don't ask me for any commitment. I'm not going to here to give out. I'm here to take. I'm a taker. That's what sexual immorality is. I want to use your body to gratify me, but I want the freedom to reject you afterwards. Right? Or can you think of a different reason than that? What does it mean when you're not ready to get married? It means you're not ready to commit yourself. It's when you're not ready to give yourself. You're definitely ready to take, though. No problem there. And so I still like that saying, love can always wait to give, but lust can never wait to take. You gotta remember that one. First time I heard that, I knew that sounds really true. Percent of U.S. births to unmarried women in 1960, only 5%. 2010, 41%. Again, there's an eightfold increase in non-married births. But the kicker is, this doesn't include children of divorce, which is another huge number. When you think of the number of divorces that we have happen, and kids then ultimately raised in a single-parent home, or even maybe in another step family that was not the family they were born into, adds millions more. How many of us sitting here, let's take a little scientific survey. How many of us sitting here come from a family where our parents were divorced? Very sizable chunk. So you can see probably another, this is why the majority of kids today come from an upbringing other than a family. It's not, they're not being raised in a family that's intact, and that was the family that they came in. Well, so what? I'll tell you what, so what. Check out this study by this group of scholars. Because marital strife, this was where they were speculating on, this has to do with divorce. and whether it's better to get divorced so that the kids don't have to be around strife and argumentation all the time. Because marital strife takes a toll on the psychological well-being, the conventional wisdom would argue that unhappily married adults who divorce then are going to be better off. They would be happier. They would be less depressed. They would have greater self-esteem and a stronger sense of personal mastery compared to those who stay married, even though they're in a conflicted marriage where we really don't love each other and all we do is fight anymore. Their findings, through studying a huge database of married and divorced people, no, none of this is true at all. Instead, they find unhappily married adults who divorced and separated were 5 years later when no happier than they were when they were in the marriage. Divorce did not reduce the symptoms of depression or unhappily married adults, nor did it raise their self-esteem or increase their sense of mastery. None of those things happened in the studies that they performed with this sizable sample. They said 2 out of 3 unhappily married adults who avoided divorce or separation and ended up happily married 5 years later. Instead of running away from their unhappy marriage, they stayed and fought it out, and they became happily married. 2 out of 3. That's the majority. What are we saying? We're saying, how does it feel to be an illustration of the fact that it's not a good idea to go against what Yahweh tells us to do? Because he's God. He's the one that knows what to do. We have all of our thoughts. Oh, I hate my marriage. I hate being in here. So I'll just get divorced. That'll fix me. I'll feel great. Not true. False. Here's Popino. He says the current cultural climate in the United States. This guy's an expert in marriage. He's a professor in sociology focusing on marriage. The current climate, cultural climate in the United States is not conducive to strong lasting marriages and childbearing by stable two-parent families. And this is based on a survey of teenagers he did. He says, if we hope to overcome the increase in social and economic impoverishment of our children's young people, the tide of divorce, fatherlessness, and out-of-wedlock childbearing must be stemmed. This is in his introduction to the article. But he says American teenagers, based on this survey, have expressed a growing esteem for marriage, family, and monogamy. So they have documented an increasing desire to be married and to have it be a lifelong marriage and to have it be monogamous, faithful. It's growing as we speak. People want that. And thinking about the future, an increasing number of teens say that marriage and family life are extremely important to them. Most want their marriages to be lifelong. Oh, and here's a little graph of it. Very important to have family. Look at that, 94%. Look, even the Germans think it's somewhat important. He goes on, they are pessimistic. The teenagers that he interviewed are pessimistic about the possibility of actually having a stable two-parent household. Yeah, how could you not be pessimistic when you look at what's happening, you know, in the world? Teens have become highly tolerant of out-of-wedlock childbearing, single-parent childbearing, and non-marital cohabitation. The teenagers are like, look, there's nothing wrong with that. Look, people have babies, you know, and live together, whatever. They do not seem to fully grasp the economic, social, and personal costs of single parenthood, which are immense. For instance, he says in response to the question, how likely do you think it is that you would stay married to the same person for life? Only 61% of respondents thought this was very likely. So 40% of them are always already like, I don't know. And, you know, it's the actual number is going to be higher than that don't make it. Moore and Steep found that fewer than 1 in 20 youths today strongly agree that single women should not have children, even if they want to. What about you guys? What if a girl is saying, well, I just want to have a baby, so I'm single, so I'm just going to have one? How many of you would be like, well, you shouldn't do that. That would be bad. All of you should be saying, yeah, that would be bad. Every one of you. because of the overwhelming, blanketing data of every piece of research done on this, the worst thing you can do to a kid is to make that kid come into a single-parent family. Agnes Malachy, PhD, in her paper on it says, single-parent children are far more likely to grow up in poverty, to have more health problems, to suffer from higher rates of abuse and neglect, to fail in school, to become teenage mothers themselves, to commit delinquent acts and adult crimes, and to incur failed adult marriages and other relationships. In, you know, get a scholarly journal, like the Journal of Marriage and Divorce. It's the Journal of Divorce and Remarriage, which just has articles on this every single week or every single month. Nobody disagrees that children in single-parent families are at risk, and the statistics are nasty for this. Double the likelihood of delinquency and adult criminality. Double the likeliness of failure in marriage and so forth. We say, oh, what's wrong with it? You know, let people have babies if they want to. They're single, whatever. What about the baby? Let's do a little bit of thinking about what the baby is going to be put through by that. People just don't realize how difficult this is going to be. Popenel goes on, according to research evidence, child well-being is associated with the formation of strong attachment bonds in infancy, as well as substantial interactions with at least one consistent, loving caregiver, usually a parent, especially during the first 3 years. Very formative, very sensitive. Children are at this age. He says, from the standpoint of child well-being, therefore, it's not reassuring that most high school students believe it makes no difference if both parents work full-time. Wrong! It does make an absolute difference. And so we have the American way where, you know, the first things first, which is the career, that's always first, money. And as far as kids, we'll just shunt them into a daycare center here. Hopefully somebody will love them. That's not going to happen. They're not being paid to love, okay? Hopefully they don't get abused there or mistreated in any way, but they cannot substitute for that parent being there with that child. Yeah, it doesn't have to be the mom. I would favor the mom for a number of key reasons, especially in the early months. It could be the father, but it's got to be somebody who is there to love the child. And yes, it does mean sacrifice, and it means you step out of that career for that period of time. He says, compared to teenage boys, teenage girls are significantly more likely to approve of single parenthood, cohabitation, and staying single rather than marrying. Oh, man. Girls, you're the ones that suffer the most in this. You're the one that gets stuck with a child or two or three that you can't handle and trying to figure out how to have a career and raise your children. Why would you approve of this? No, you weren't the ones they interviewed. That's what I remember. These attitudes, he says, represent a dramatic departure from earlier times. Yeah. He says, in the final analysis, then, the surveys point up a growing disparity between teens' ideals of marriage and family life, which, if anything, are getting stronger than ever, on the one hand, and their pessimism about actually achieving those goals. This is a sad situation. Kids today wanting real love. Why not? That's what we're built for. That's exactly how we were designed. But looking around, seeing their own families, their friends' families, seeing the disaster of failed marriage on every side, pretty pessimistic about whether you can pull this off. Let me give you the key to pulling it off. You can pull it off. You need God in your life. And you need to get this whole thing back under God's leadership. If you want to set up a family, you need to have God at the center of the family and oriented around his way of life that he teaches, and then you can succeed at marriage. Yes, you can. We've got succeeding marriages all over the room here. And divorce is virtually unknown among our are people that get married here. It's different when couples come into Xenos already married, because a lot of times those marriages are in such deep trouble by the time they get here. The damage sometimes can be pretty severe. In part, he says, this disparity may reflect the teen's own life experiences in growing up with divorce, single parenthood, and cohabitation. Yep. This is where we're at. He's got another piece, same guy, called 10 Myths of Divorce. I just picked a couple out that were interesting. Because people learn from their bad experiences, second marriages tend to be more successful than first marriages. You know, it's like, okay, I saw what I did wrong last time. So this time I got divorced then, but now I'm going to get remarried and I've learned my lesson. Nah, not true at all. Actually, divorce rate of remarriages is far higher than that of first marriages, about twice as likely. How can that be? How can I not have learned anything from that first marriage when I got divorced? Well, that's what the data shows. Living together before marriage is a good way to reduce the chances of eventually divorcing. We already touched on this one earlier. That is far from true. Actually, he says many studies have found that those who live together before marriage have a considerably higher chance of eventually divorcing. The reasons for this are not well understood. I understand it. You shall not commit adultery. Signed, Yahweh. That is wrong. If you do that, it will hurt your chance in marriage. Yes, it will. You need to stop doing that immediately. Divorce might cause problems for children who are affected by it, but by and large, these problems are not long-lasting, and the children recover relatively quickly. Both small qualitative studies and large-scale long-term empirical studies show that many problems associated with divorce, especially those involving interpersonal relationships, are long-lasting and, in fact, may become worse in adulthood. They've done these studies where they've tracked kids for 25 years. And they are now divorcees. They are now unable to form successful relationships, and nothing skews your chances worse than being a child of divorce. So all of you that held your hands up, you've got a major challenge ahead of you not to fall back and do the same thing that happened to you. And you're going to be twice as likely to have it happen. But I think these are all statistics that have to do with just general culture, nothing to do with them being into God or anything like that. So I think we can change this around substantially. I know we can. And we need to get back to doing it God's way. Because they're more cautious in entering marriage and also have a strong determination to avoid the possibility of divorce, children who grew up in a home broken by divorce tend to have less divorces themselves. The first part of the statement is true. They are cautious. They are more determined not to be divorces themselves. As a whole, not true. Marriages of children of divorce actually have a much higher rate of divorce than the marriages of children from intact families. In the children of divorce, the sense of commitment to a lifelong marriage has been undermined. Children really pay the price. Little children are the ones that pay the price for our sexual immorality. They pay, and they pay with blood. It's really harsh to study this material. Well, I could go on and talk about sickness and death, which are also measurable perils here, but we all know about that, and I'm not even going to belabor it. And so we go back to this preposition where we were at, that, you know, we don't need Yahweh telling us what to do with our sexuality, and we've progressed in this whole area. We're way ahead of where they were as ancient people. We really have it together today. And I would suggest that none of this is true. Reality, the actual statistics of what is happening, what does that show? It shows that Yahweh was in the right. And it shows that we are in the wrong with our views that sexual immorality is no problem. It is a problem. And it will break you. If you break God's law, that will break you. And it's not that God is coming down and zapping you. It's just that this is the way it works. You can't violate God's law. You can just illustrate it. Okay. Well, so what we've seen here. First of all, we saw that all moral thinking needs to come out of the moral God who created the world. We saw that the nuclear family is ordained by God, and that should be the centerpiece. We should try to form successful nuclear families. That should be a goal for all of us. It is a goal, according to the literature. All of us, you know, the unprecedented levels are saying, yeah, that's what I want. And we can also do it, but we need to follow the rest of what God lays out in his program for us. We saw that humans are way too valuable to ever murder, to ever kill wrongfully. And we saw that adultery is a damaging and a morally wrong act that will harm you and your children in the worst ways. No way to minimize this. It's just awful. So, all of these prepositions are still true today, even though this is not our covenant. We're not actually under this covenant that these people made with God. As we move through the history of God's dealings with people, this was a temporary event, this Mosaic covenant. And even in the Old Testament, it says that one day God would start a new covenant that would be different than this one where he wrote on the stones to Moses. A covenant where he says, I will write my laws on their hearts and on their minds, I'll write them. The laws of God put into the heart directly. And it's all because in our covenant, the new covenant, as it's called, that Jesus brought, this whole slate of moral law was shown to be not a way that you get to God through this. Yeah, there's still moral principles. These still apply, but not as a way to get to God, not as a basis for a covenant. That instead, what we have is, it says, we're no longer under law, but under grace. Our program is called grace. This is where God says, how would you like a free gift that you can't afford or pay for? And we say, okay. And he gives us absolute forgiveness for everything we've ever done, total acceptance by him, and a guarantee of eternal life. That's our covenant. That's the grace covenant. The new covenant that we're under. All you have to do is everyone has to accept the gift if they want it. They have to receive Christ, inviting Christ into your life. Then the Holy Spirit comes into you. And this is why he says, my laws are written on their hearts, is because the Holy Spirit within starts to just show you, like, you just feel uncomfortable moving in certain directions, such as violence, such as immorality, things like that. And it makes you feel uneasy. I don't feel right about this. I feel more excited this way over here. And having the Holy Spirit in you changes your outlook. It changes your sense of what's right and wrong. And you come to view it more the way God does. Well, we still have three more. Haven't finished. And we'll take those up next time. Let's draw the line there for tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.